This is an Enterprise Times security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Richard Ford, CTO at Integrity 360. We're going to be talking about managed detection and response. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself and Integrity 360?
So my name is Richard Ford and I'm CTO for Integrity 360, and I've been with Integrity for the last 10 years and counting and enjoying every single minute of it. Now, I've been working in the security industry pretty much most of my working life. A lot of that is focused on helping organizations, helping our customers to improve their security posture, to make sure that they are fully aware of the threats that they face and making sure that they have the controls in place to defend against those, but really importantly, those controls are as effective as they actually think they are or hope they are. In my role as the CTO, I look after our cybersecurity strategy and our products and working with our customers as part of that sort of customer engagement.
Historically, we've been a very passive industry, waiting for something to happen and then reacting to it. That's given control to the attacker. Managed detection and response is about turning that around. But how easy is it for organizations to move from passive to active security?
It is a challenge. A lot of organizations are passive and still taking knee-jerk reactions. We see it over and over again. We have an excellent IR team led by Patrick Ragg. Their everyday activity is helping customers that are dealing with incidents. Getting close to that, a lot of the incidents are very preventable, but they haven't been prevented because the controls weren't in place. We spent a lot of time talking about the cost of breaches. Ransomware is impacting organizations all of the time. The ransomware threat actors are getting better and better at finding the right levers to pull to impact businesses, to extort businesses. We see the cost of those breaches being the impact of the business, not being able to transact. We see the brand damage. We've got some good examples of where there's been huge impact of a 50 million turnover organization being impacted that they reported to us to the tune of around 7.1 million. That's because of the brand impact that has lost them key deals. But there's also a huge cost in putting things right that could have been dealt with over time that would have mitigated the incident in the first place. But that knee-jerk reaction, which isn't being proactive, they say, do you know what? We need all these tools. We need these capabilities. We need the expertise, the full people process and technology to put in place. On the one hand, we see that still happening a lot. But one of the things that the security industry is very guilty of is trying to sell on fear. It is good to be made aware of these activities. Cybersecurity now is a board level priority and risk to businesses, which is hugely important because it now means that it's getting focus, it's getting budget, and organizations, seeing what's happening to their peers or, the potential things that could happen, are investing to become more proactive in putting cybersecurity controls in place. If we break that question down into a couple of parts, that'd be the first part of organizations in general and their approach to cybersecurity. We see it becoming a lot more proactive, but still a lot of closing the gate after the horse has bolted. But the other side of it is, what do we do when we are putting the controls in place? A lot of the times, historically, our services, our approach and our processes were reactive. So we were waiting for a tool to tell us that there was a problem. Then we'll react to it and have a look at that point. Quite often that's a little bit too late. More often than not, we probably haven't got the coverage we think we've got. And we're not finding out about something that we need to have found out about a little bit more proactively. We can break that down in itself into two. How do we ensure that our services, our capabilities are delivering what we expect of them? They have the coverage that we have in place. So that's being proactive in saying, if we take SIM or SIEM, depending on how you want to pronounce it, we might have a SIEM platform in place that we think is giving us visibility across what's happening in our environment. Well, that might have been installed 3 years ago, and it might have been great at the time. It was covering everything we need, but our organization will have evolved over that time. And more often than not, we're not being proactive to say, actually, have we got complete coverage? Is that delivering exactly what we need? Have we got the right threat content in place? Are we collecting data from the right assets? How many assets are reporting that we're expecting that aren't? And so that element of proactivity is often forgotten. We don't see security controls keeping pace with change in the security threat landscape and also in organizations' changes in their environment. And the other side of it is, what do we need to do to really detect threats? Because tools and platforms are there to bring us telemetry. They're there to highlight incidents through alerts. But we will get noise, and we will also miss items because we're not proactively going to hunt for them. So we need to evolve our process from not being reactional to waiting for a tool set to tell us that there's a problem, to be using that as an addition to our proactive processes to go and actively hunt for the threats that are facing us.
I can probably craft the 2-hour podcast just out of taking that response to pieces. So let's try and focus on some things. You talked about the cost of a breach. Vendors have sold tools into companies who sold them to the board, as you say, often on fear. If you don't have it, bad things will happen to you. But they don't often see that as a benefit, just as box ticking. How do we change that view to one of, does this product assure us that we are protected? Because if we are going to change the type of tools, culture, processes, the business is going to want to see some benefit from it. And at the moment, all they see is very large organizations who they know have spent millions on security still falling to things like ransomware. What becomes the change in that conversation?
If we look at organizations that have been breached, this is what we see in some of the incident response engagements that we're involved in. There is a mismatch between expectation and what's actually there. Some of it is because we've put a tick in a box. That happens a little bit too often. Sometimes it's compliance and audit and regulation are telling us that we need X, so we're going to put X in place and we've got that tick in the box. That's something that's being said for 10 years at least, talking about things like SIEM platforms. But it is still true today, and we see the expectations. Well, we've got ISO 27001, so we know we're secure. But you know that it covers a very niche bit of the business rather than being the entire organization, but it might be satisfying an audit requirement as a security control.
It's rather like the MOT on your car. The moment your car rolls out of that MOT test point, you can no longer be sure it meets all the requirements because it's an absolute moment in time test. That means nothing until the next time something is tested.
In my youth, I had a Peugeot 2.0 something or 3.0 something. The gear link was all held together with cable ties, and that would get through the MOT no problem. But I had to question myself, was that safe to have on the road? You can get a tick in a box and it's point in time. That applies to not just audit and review. The deployment of any technology and tool and solution is only as good if you don't touch it again, if you're not reviewing it, if you're not trying to enhance it, even just keeping it at the same level that it was, it will just degrade over time, which is something that organizations fall into very easily with a lot of technologies. We talked about vendors. There is a huge amount of technology out there. Look at the Momentum Cyberscape, the most recent one. Just in network and security alone, there's 100 plus vendors, all with different technologies. Everybody obviously trying to market those as the latest and greatest. And we can find ourselves looking at technology as being the answer to all of our problems. But without the people and the process around it, that technology isn't going to be effective, or its effectiveness will wear away relatively quickly.
Let's say I sit on the board. Somebody comes to me and says, we've been ticking boxes, but now we need to change our approach. It's no longer good enough to wait for the attackers to come at us. We've got to go out and take the fight to them. But to do that, I want you to give me another $10 million to invest in our security team. Well, for most C-suite directors, they look at the bottom line. And it was $10 million last year, $10 million the year before that, and $10 million the year before that. Many start to see this as just a money pit. That's got to change. We see some change when we talk about risk to the board, but that doesn't always filter down to the practicalities on the ground. For managed detection and response to be effective, there has to be a whole mindset change. What is it, in particular, you see as a trigger factor for people to make that change?
Something goes alongside with that. Yeah, there's risk. That should be the driver for most decisions. We need to have a risk-based approach to pretty much everything we do. But we should also be looking at consolidation. We can't keep just spending on new all the time. Something we see over and over again is overlapping security technologies that have been point products bought for a specific purpose to meet a specific requirement. But there's something else in the environment that does the same, or there is a path to consolidate both technologies and vendors so that we are getting the very best out of our spend. Budgets are very much finite and difficult to get and to get approvals to spend. Back to your original question, if someone came and said we need $10 million, I said, yes, it's a great investment to let's enhance our security. But we do need to make sure that it's not wasted spend. There's a whole piece on the human factor that I think gets missed. I will bring it back to managed detection response in a second, but there's a huge element of the people factor and how we engage people in terms of security behaviors and culture that isn't a technology fix. Security awareness training tools and phishing tools as the holy grail, but a little bit too much appliance in place. If we bring it back to MDR, managed detection and response, a service that you would take from an MDR provider like ourselves, threat monitoring, detection and response as a function inside an organization, whether that's delivered by a third party, whether you've got the budget and the capability to have that in-house, which is difficult. But an MDR service needs to be able to deliver that proactive capability, be able to enhance the security posture and the ability to detect threats over time without needing to have a complete rip out of everything that's there. It's about how can we integrate? How can we mesh together what we have? Gartner used the term cybersecurity mesh architecture, but it's how can we integrate our technologies and tools together so we can put the right processes in place, get the right people and expertise that are going to operate those tools so that existing spend is being utilized so that we're not having to just re-spend, rip out, rip and replace so that we can get to that point where the product is greater than the sum of the parts.
I'd like to return to the number of tools we've got. This has happened because we've bought into multiple vendors, often with slightly overlapping tools. But as vendors have evolved, we've taken the view of overlap as being good, because that means strength in depth. But the tools never work seamlessly together. They all have their own flaws. More importantly, we don't have the staff, the time, the knowledge, or often the analytics to understand what the different tools are telling us in their own different way. Correlating that into a single view of what is really going on is incredibly hard. But telling people they've got to do more with less is often seen about saving money, not delivering the best solution. How does that work for consolidation of security tools? How receptive are people to the idea of reducing the landscape of tools they use and trusting that what they will get is a coherent, cohesive platform?
Very receptive is the answer, because that's being driven by customers rather than the market, in my opinion. If I'm talking to customers, they recognize that they have too many vendors, too many technologies, too many partners, too many services. They are actively building the programs to reduce the number of technologies, the number of vendors, the number of partners, so they can get to a more consolidated position so that they can free up budget. They might have other priorities that then their budget might be shifting to other areas, particularly if they're only just starting on their cloud journey. They're going to be stuck between two environments that both need equal amount of attention and security. A lot of organizations have flipped from being cloud first to being cloud only in the last sort of 18 months, which obviously helps because you're consolidating everything in that one place. It's a natural process that all organizations that already have either been told enough by analysts like Gartner and by different vendors, or whether they've come to it by their own path to say, we need to do something about the sheer amount of tools that we've got. There's a couple of ways to talk about this. Quite often, organizations find that they've got a lack of expertise and resources in their teams. It is extremely hard to try and find and retain the staff, and increasingly difficult. If they're taxing the limited staff members that they have with having to look at multiple panes of glass, then something is going to fall through the cracks. That is something we see over and over again. We see some good examples of some IR engagements. You know, by having, yes, there's a myriad of tools there that are trying to protect the customer environment. But without the expertise, without having so many different tools to deal with, their effectiveness is not what it needs to be. And a lot of the breaches that we've seen and we've investigated do relate to tools that aren't quite configured where they need to be, or where teams are being overwhelmed by the amount of noise coming out of them and they've gone to an inbox that's got a rule on there that says markers red, or even worse, markers delete and remove from the system.
That opens up a whole bunch of challenges. How do companies decide which tools they're going to get rid of, especially if that overlap leads to two almost identical solutions. At some point, they've got to make a decision. What tool do they stay with? What tool do they get rid of? In addition, they're going to end up with gaps no matter how they do this. And they're going to have to find something to fill those gaps. So when you engage with companies, how do they go about that decision process of what is best for them? What don't they need? And more importantly, how do they fight off the vendor sales teams who are going to say, oh, no, 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 keep us, dump the other one?
Well, that's an easy answer. It's a partner with a trusted security partner that is agnostic, that can guide them down that path and keep the vendor sales teams at bay. We talk about signal to noise ratio, bring them just the signal and not the noise that's being generated around that particular platform. But it is a process to go through to understand what tools we need in the environment. It's something that we help our customers with. A starting point for any organization is understanding what they need, where their gaps are, what their risks are, where are their risks. If they're not already aligned to a framework like NIST cybersecurity framework or the CIS critical security controls, then that's the first step you need to take. Then have a very mature look at your requirements, where your gaps are, and then prioritize what's the biggest need. I'm a big fan of the CIS critical security controls as a technical person because they're a bit more technical focused than just being entirely risk governance focused. They provide you with a prioritized list of here's the things to tackle in this order that will give you a good view of where you need to be. In terms of being able to compare technologies side by side as they start to overlap, there is a case of looking for expertise that have that experience across them to understand what is the right fit for you as an organization. And that will be on an organization by organization basis, depending on how they operate and what they see as their key risks and the threats that they consider themselves facing.
You talked about understanding the quantity of information that we get earlier. In passive mode, you're simply reading telemetry and you're trying to interpret that. We've got increasing numbers of AI and machine learning systems that to some degree do a first level of analysis to eliminate duplicates and hopefully reduce the vast amount of false positives we see. But when we become proactive, we need to change how we use that information. We need to change what information we get in, work out what is important to us, and what we're actually going to do with the data. How do organizations make that mental shift between waiting for it to come to them and going and getting it?
There isn't an either or. It is making sure that you're reacting to the alerts because the tools are there, and vendors put a lot of effort into creating tools that will detect threats. They have their research and development teams in place. There is undoubtedly a huge amount of value in their platforms, and the alerts that are generated need to be actioned. We can't ignore what's there. We need to react, but it is changing how do we do things more proactively. It's being realistic that your resources that are in place right now are probably stretched on doing the reactive work that they need to do. So we need to look at how can we enhance them? Do we need to bring specialist people in? Do we need to bring in a third party that has the expertise that can bring that proactive element into our organization? And we talk about sort of data that we need to look at. The more data that we have, the better. But most people that have any security experience has been anywhere near a SIEM platform knows that the more you collect, the more you have to pay. And that's just a fact of life. So you need to be specific about what you collect, understanding where your critical assets are, what are the critical log sources. That's the expertise that we bring to bear when we're onboarding our customers and throughout the life of their service, is making sure that we're very clear on what is valuable in terms of log data, the data that we collect. And then it's what do we do with that data? We need to make sure that we're normalizing that data in a way that is accessible and easily searchable so that we can look for the threats that we want to go and hunt for. What should we be hunting for? It's probably the follow-on question. Looking at the risk-based anomalies, have we been able to establish a baseline that we can look for anomalies against? Quite often, they're going to be relatively low value, but can we piece those together to say there's enough of a negative risk profile around a specific user, a particular asset? We need to proactively go and have a look at that and not wait until we're getting a high critical alert from some activity that's related to it. There is looking at those anomalies in the environment, but we want to get into the real threat hunting. Then we need threat intelligence that's going to guide us down that path, that's going to say, here's the tactics, techniques, and procedures that we need to go and look for. It's important to talk about intelligence. There's two sides to threat intelligence. There's IOCs, which stands for indicators of compromise, but the indicators of somebody else's compromise. They are of limited value to a certain extent. A lot of IOCs are IP addresses, host names, domain names, file hashes, all things that are relatively trivial to change for an attacker. Any well-organized and enthusiastic attacker, should we say, will take the steps to not reuse and reutilize attack infrastructure and hashes that they've previously used to try and remain undetected. The thing that is common across attacks is the tactics, techniques, and procedures they're using and the way they're trying to breach an organization, the way they're trying to establish initial footholds, initial execution, or the way they're standing up their attack infrastructure. We even get pre-attack to a certain extent. That's the information that's really valuable for us because they're the things that we should be going to hunt for. So what are the tactics, techniques, and procedures that are relevant? And let's see if we can identify those.
I'd like to touch on the specificity point that you raised there. We have large infrastructures. We have multiple products, often many multiple products. But we have no idea what we have in our organization. But not all of those products are forward-facing or critical to the business. And not all of those products are at risk. One of the problems we've had over the last few years is there's been a lot of noise around patch everything and deal with it immediately, which is the right approach. But for most organizations, given the size of their landscape, if they patched everything immediately, they just wouldn't have the time, let alone time to do everything else they need to do. So one of the key things for me in specificities is how do we assess a client's landscape? How do we tier that into what must be a react now, what we can have a little bit of time to think about, and what, quite frankly, we can ring fence because it's never going to be an issue, as it's not going to be exposed.
If we're talking about vulnerabilities, prioritization is key. We have a customer that has a 14-day patching SLA for critical and high across everything in their environment, which for me is the gold standard of patching regimes. How do they get there? They've identified or articulated the risk to the business, the huge benefit of undertaking such a program and getting buy-in at all levels to say this is something that we have it as a key risk indicator. If there's anything that's unpatched over 14 days, then we're on it straight away. There's an entire exercise of building the business case and the cost model for how to make that happen. So you know, that's an anomaly and an outlier. In most other cases, it is about how do we prioritize? Just to clarify, that wasn't a small organization. That's a big multinational organization. The more realistic situation is that there are things that need to be patched that we need to prioritize on. And there's things that can be a little bit further down the line. And there can be things that we can accept the risk on and ignore, particularly where it comes to having business impact. So your question is, how do we prioritize those types of activities? One is on intelligence. We have a huge amount of vulnerabilities in an environment, but we need to look at which ones are being actively compromised and targeted by attackers. So they're the ones that we start thinking about first. And importantly, the ones that are externally facing. So can they be compromised? If you've got any system that is externally facing, that is vulnerable and is a vulnerability that is being actively targeted, let's drop everything, get that patched, or even virtually patch it as much as possible if there's a patch available. That's extremely important. How do we deal with all of the rest? And then how do we go through that prioritization process? We partner with XM Cyber, which is an amazing tool that allows us to assist customers with that approach. We can look at intelligence, if we can look at where's your biggest bang for your buck in terms of applying patches that's going to kill the most vulnerabilities and getting visibility of what is the state of your vulnerabilities. Are you making progress? We utilize XM Cyber's attack path management tool, which allows us to assess every single system inside the environment, whether that's your cloud environment, endpoints, your servers, to understand what risk that they pose, and particularly to map out exactly how your critical assets can be compromised by the chain of events that can occur through your environment. And be able to advise, this is the reason why you need to patch this system that is a million miles away from your critical assets. Here is the chain, here's the choke point, here's the area that we can focus on putting the mitigation in place that is actually ultimately going to protect that system that is in the backend system. So we utilize the tools that are there to be able to prioritize, making sure that we're applying things holistically and not just focused on those critical assets and those critical tools.
How do you create that complex asset register? It's not simply a case of going to a client and saying, what's a critical system and isn't. To be honest, a lot of clients don't know about the dependencies inside their infrastructure. We see that when they suddenly do a restore and discover that the systems don't come back up. There's always that tiny little table or application which has been overlooked. But because it wasn't backed up, the rest of it no longer functions. So asking an organization of how it works is not simple. You need to monitor them over a period of time and see where function calls, applications and data go. The companies come to you with that data or some understanding of the tools and the requirements for that information? Or does that become a whole new starting point?
It is typically a starting point. Now, I'll talk about the COS critical security controls. If you look at points 1 and 2, really they're all about know yourself, know your assets, know your applications that are installed and where they're in use. Are there any instances of unauthorized applications or assets that are unauthorized in the environment? And maintain a CMDB. I think most people would probably laugh at that because it's very, very common that there isn't a CMDB or there isn't confidence in what's in there because it's not actively maintained. That is the first step on the security journey that is very often skipped. But we can't sit there and say, well, you haven't got a CMDB, it's up to date, it can't help you. That's not helpful. There's two different aspects to it. If we think about vulnerabilities in environment, that is the job of threat exposure management as a whole, to understand what's in the environment, how can we prioritize that, where can we walk the customer through, here is what we've, from our discovery scans, this is what we're seeing in the environment. We can't tell them what's critical. They will need to know what's critical, but they need to be able to find out, well, actually, who owns these systems, what's on there, so we can start trying to build that picture. If we start putting a little CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and an availability score against them, then we can start understanding these are the things that are really important to a business. If we talk from a managed detection and response point of view, touching back on the previous question, we've got huge environments where we quite often focus our monitoring in specific areas. So how do we get that broad view of everything that's in the environment? And then how do we understand how they operate, how their interaction between assets and between applications and between users? That is where tools like network detection and response, you know, user behavior analytics can bring in that capability through machine learning. What we've seen in some large breaches where the ICO is involved in terms of investigating how the breaches occurred and looking at how data was protected, that is one of the questions that they ask. Do you have a security baseline? Do you have an understanding of a network security baseline? What activity is going on in your environment? What normal looks like, so that you can identify what is anomalous behavior? Most organizations, unless you've taken that data into your SIEM platform and you've put the effort to try and build a baseline against a few different areas, the network activity, user activity, or you've invested in a tool that will do that for you, the answer is invariably no. I see that those types of tools will become increasingly important. They're bringing that automated machine learning in place. They're able to identify peer groups. They're able to say, well, actually, these are how things act as normal in your environment. Now this system here is contacting a system that it wouldn't normally contact. This user is behaving in this way. Then we can start surfacing up those things that we need to look at. And that takes us back to that proactivity over taking the reactionary point of where, you know, we can step into things a little bit earlier in the attack path.
This is where I normally put people on the spot in podcasts. You're stood in a room and in front of you is an audience of people who know they want managed detection and response. But what do you tell them?
The things that they would take away, if they're honest, they would look at the scale of the challenge that's in front of them and how realistic is it to cover it in-house with their current team. That's probably the main thing. If we look at the volume of alerts, particularly if we look at that volume of data, are we getting effective use out of these controls? Are we able to scour that data to look for the needle in a haystack? And do we know what the right needles are that we're looking for? It's less around managed detection and response. It's about building that threat monitoring, detection and response capability. And if they looked at that and said, can we build that? Are we going to be able to bring in the analysts, the responders? Are we going to be able to bring in the threat engineering teams that are going to build the content we need to look for? Are we going to be able to bring in threat intelligence into our organization that's going to inform us in terms of what we're looking for, but also guiding our security strategy overall? And the answer is invariably going to be, no, we don't have the budget to do that. Or if we do, can we do that 24/7 to make sure that we're monitoring for and detecting threats around the clock. We need a team that's going on to do that, that augments our current capability and our current team that's in place and isn't a separate, at arm's length organization that is handing us challenges and issues. I think that's the common complaint from traditional managed services. So an MDR provider should be providing you not just with something that, you know, not creating more noise, not creating more alerts for you to look at, because that's the job of the MDR provider. They should be able to take that from start to finish as much as possible to be able to reduce the time to respond, reduce the time to contain an incident, but also work within the current processes and current team to get the most value.
Richard, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure to join you.